Welcome to this week's episode of the Breaking Britain Contest with me, Dr. Alex Clarkson, here at King's College London, and my colleague, Dr. Russell Foster.
Hello, everyone.
This podcast explores the pressures unraveling the unity of Britain and reopening the future of the island of Ireland in a European context. And this week, we want to look at the issue of what one could call the crisis of the British state, or what we can call the different pressures on UK unity from a geopolitical perspective, the perspective of foreign policy and defense policy, and to a certain extent also space policy, since this is an increasingly important aspect of what a lot of states are doing in the geopolitical context of the early 21st century. And as an ideal person to guide us through these kinds of issues, this week we've invited Dr. Bleddyn Bowen. He's lecturer in international relations at the University of Leicester. He's an expert in space warfare, space policy, international relations in the context of outer space and the water geopolitics. He looks at strategic theory and military thought. And most recently, he's published a really interesting book on space strategy, space power, and geopolitics, which was published by Edinburgh University Press. He's published in a lot of academic journals, written blogs and op-eds, all covering these kinds of issues of space policy, geopolitics, military policy, and strategy, which are also impact on these underlying debates about British unity and identity in the early 21st century. He's worked at the NATO Engages Summit and the Lawrence Livermore National Laboratory and the Royal College of Defence Studies, RUSI, and other major institutions as well. So with no further ado, I'd like to welcome Bleddyn to our podcast.
Hi, Alex and Russell. Thanks very much for having me on. And I've listened to every single one of your episodes, partly in preparation for today as well. So thanks very much for having me on. And I think this podcast is a great initiative of yours. So thanks very much for having me on. And thanks for the very nice introduction.
Thank you, and thanks everyone for joining us again for the Breaking Britain podcast. And we're honoured to, as Alex says, we're honoured to have with us today Dr. Bleddyn Bowen. Now, Bleddyn, back in the day, I used to be a geographer, so I'm very much looking forward to discussing astropolitics and astrogeography in relation to defence. But I suppose the first question, let's start off down here on Earth. Now, In his campaign for the 2019 general election, Boris Johnson had promised that the armed forces would not be cut in the event of a Conservative victory in December 2019. But then, in March, the Integrated Review and Defence Command paper, which the UK government released, it promised what was termed a root and branch reassessment of Great Britain's foreign policy and military strategy in the aftermath of Brexit, the biggest constitutional issue that we've had since the Second World War. So, given the proposals that have been mentioned in the Integrated Review and Defence paper, you know, cutting back numbers of tanks to pre-Cold War levels, really cutting the British Army even more than the Royal Navy and the Royal Air Force. I suppose the first question, will these proposals and these plans that have been set out in these documents, how are these going to change Great Britain's geopolitical role in the future global system?
I think the integrated review itself is not going to change very, very much in terms of the general trajectory of where the UK is going as a military actor. The UK, from the way I see, has been in a position of, you know, or trajectory of relative decline for many, many years, and the integrated review isn't changing that. Now, for me, the only thing that's really interesting from the integrated review, in contrast to this general pathway of decline, is highlighting some areas that it wants to make targeted investments in. So we've got the Dominic Cummings, spectre haunting the integrated view with artificial intelligence, novel technologies, and also, of course, space, my area of expertise, coming into it. So apart from those novel, space is a novel, but for the Ministry of Defence, it pretty much is a novel area of operations and technologies. The rest of it seems just to be continuing it, and even the maritime emphasis on this integrated review is continuing what the 2015 Strategic Defence Security Review did, which was very maritime in orientation. It's the Army that suffered a lot in 2015 as well, whereas the RAF and the Navy relatively did all right, again, as Afghanistan and Iraq were, coming down in terms of the priority by 2015. So for me, I think, trying to think maybe 10, 15 years from now, we'll be looking back and just seeing the IR as just part of that longer trend rather than some break. And you ask about the role of Britain in the world, as I'm sure some of you have seen with me on Twitter already, I don't like the idea of role, but if you do anything with British defence policy and strategy, you can't ignore people talking about Britain's role in the world, as is true for many other countries. But I don't like using that word because it invites people to put a spin on whatever fantastical caricature they want about a state, and it personifies a state too much about whatever country they're talking about at any given time. What's important are the capabilities that are actually being divested and invested in, and it seems like heavy combat land capabilities are what's being targeted, for the most part, rather than everything else. So the commitment to Baltic defence is going to be more maritime rather than land-based in the years to come, really, but that direction was already there. Otherwise, in terms of the role, I think the only role you can apply to the UK is that it's a status quo power. Anything else is filler or spin. Like in some of the literature, some scholars or analysts call for a muddling through approach or smart muddling through, which is a way of saying wherever we end up is where we want it to be, and therefore we've been very successful in doing that, sort of not having a plan and just sort of hoping things turn out for the best, which some people have said this government is particularly characterised by in their strategic approach to things. Others talk about regional power, an offshore balancer. These are variations on a theme of the UK just sort of sitting pretty in an international system it's been the beneficiary of for the most part, this so-called rules-based international order, which some scholars have, like Patrick Porter are now critiquing again, more from the US perspective. But it overly politicises and sanitises, I think, a lot of discussion about what is the role of political violence in the name of the British state in the 21st century today, and when and how and if should it be deployed or not. The question of role doesn't help discuss those questions in an intellectually honest manner.
I have possibly a follow-on question, but it connects to the next theme that maybe you wanted to look at. But how far are these discussions about a British role in the world? How far are they more a reflection of particular elite factional infighting in London than they are globally? And what do you think these debates in the integrated review and the way it was structured tells us about the self-image people have in London? I think that links on to what we want to look at in a minute.
Yeah, I think that's a great question. And this will be more anecdotal rather than research-based insight, given the communities that I do engage with. And I used to teach at the Staff College in Shrivenham, in Oxfordshire. And I think there is definitely a certain part of British culture that is mostly involved in these sort of discussions than others. I've got particular views as to how this translates into devolved politics and the devolved government as well, but I'm sure we'll get to that later. But in terms of the narratives, yeah, I think there's definitely a lot of benign self-imaging that goes on. And there's this sort of harking back to the Second World War about, the UK state, well, the British Empire really was there fighting a clear evil that was fascism. So there's sort of a lot of harking back to that and how then the Cold War was about fighting the evil of totalitarian communism, especially in the early Cold War. And that still shapes a lot of thinking today. And that, in a way, they haven't even gotten to the end of history argument of Francis Fukuyama, where that sort of big ideological divide just is not quite what animates a lot of everyday thinking about this. It's more about keeping the light switched on. Certain groups of people within certain countries and societies enriching themselves and forming patronage systems based on whatever structures and resources that they have to hand. And I take a much more of a thick of it approach, really, try and get through one day to the next without buggering up too much, and making sure that people you don't like, you know, don't get in. For me, that is what grand strategy is about, but I'm a very cynical person. But in terms of the narratives, the idea of role, Britain being, you know, a champion of the rules-based order, apart from in certain limited and specific ways, possibly with this government, championing free trade, although, you know, free trade is not really free trade, but anyway, that's another discussion. There are these sort of you know, sacred cows we have in our terms when we talk about British grand strategy. They're just so problematic. And in our seminars in Staff College, and similarly in other universities that I've taught at, when you restrict discussions of British defence and strategy to the language and the concepts that you see in things like the IR, the Integrated Review, or the Strategic Defence and Security Review, you get away from the real discussion of power politics in security and, you know, human politics. You don't really get at the anarchy of the international system. You don't get at the interests that are involved in who makes defence policy and why. And when we got into the question of Britain's role in the world and the prosperity agenda, those discussions, those seminars that were based on those documents were so sterile and bland, and they were avoiding getting the students or the officers to actually talk about the hard decisions and trade-offs that are needed when we have limited resources to do whatever. I think it shows how damaging a lot of the discourse can be, and how it's a certain elite of people talking to themselves in many ways.
I do think that this is one of the interesting things, and this flows into the other question, but there is an element here as well. I found it interesting was the French responses to the Integrated Review, and the extent to which you have people in the French military staff who are used to operating in pretty brutal, hostile environments in the Sahel, saying, well, all this high tech stuff and all this planning is great, but we need to operate in environments where this stuff breaks down all the time. And how will it help us? And what I found interesting is how abstracted British strategic debate has become from, you know, what happens when all of these capabilities have, what happens when they hit actual conditions, social, political, economic, environmental on the ground, and how people, and this comes to the big question to Russell and I wanted to have next, was how it's sort of people prefer discussing these things in terms of abstraction in a UK context, rather than concrete political dynamics that affect them in the UK. Right. And I think that's why we also brought you on, because you have a lot of interesting thoughts about this. About, and so it leads on to our next to a theme that we were really interested in, is how, you know, how do you think the tensions over the unity of the United Kingdom between and within UK nations affect these debates about UK's military and foreign policy strategy? Because it's around, it's part of the atmosphere we're operating in. Yet when the Integrated Review came out and the Defence Command paper came out, it was very abstract about Indo-Pacific. Now, I remember arguing with people saying, well, actually, the French have the basis there. You know, the British have one or two positions, but the French, you know, why don't we work together? You know, and that became toxic because the EU dynamics, and that you couldn't think of a kind of a sharing. And that all became very abstracted about what we can do in the Indo-Pacific. And at the same time, we have all these debates about Scotland, Wales, Northern Ireland that affect power. Yeah. Right. So how do you think, I mean, but you're closer to this. How do you think the what interactions do you think there are between the UK unity debate and this foreign policy and defence strategy debates?
I don't think there's that much of a connection at the moment, to the detriment of both discussions that are going on. And yeah, there's still a lot of exceptionalism around a lot of people who discuss British defence policy and strategy. I mean, British people love to talk about how the Americans are so full of themselves in terms of American exceptionalism, but the British are just as bad at it when we try to talk about you know, Britain. I mean, the British, a lot of British elites are obsessed with British soft power. Like, I mean, it's so intangible. I mean, you know, I don't know. I'm very skeptical of that line, but the other delusions that a lot of people talk about in the abstract. And similarly, there is that, not everyone, of course, but there is a lot of willful ignorance about domestic politics in the UK, in the UK defence and security policy and commentary analyst communities, where it's like they still see Britain in terms of the 1945 post-war Attlee sort of big consensus UK state angle when that really hasn't been around since Agri Thatcher. But of course, as you know, you've had proper British political history experts on, you know, they'll have a much more nuanced view. But in terms of my views, like that really hasn't been around since Thatcher, when you get these massive fault lines happen within the UK because of the massive macroeconomic changes that were taking place first in the 70s and then the 80s. And the biggest connection that has appeared, of course, as you know, is the Trident nuclear weapons issue, because the nukes are based in Scotland. You know, they're stored there, and also the sub pens are up on the Clyde. So that's the only thing really that has shown up in any of the issues in terms of British separatism and defence policy. There's been a couple of hatchet jobs in terms of trying to portray Scotland as a threat to NATO, which is a bit far-fetched, given that the SNP has been pretty pro-NATO, like they want to be part of NATO, you know. So there's that element, but I think we can safely ignore that. So I don't think there has been that much of a connection between it, and that is bad for the discussion, because if Scotland does manage to go independent, the Trident question is one of the big bargaining chips that it has. It can make life far easier for the remnant of the UK by just doing effectively what Ukraine did with Sebastopol, saying, right, this can be sort of your enclave, because even if we want to get rid of them, it'll be a 30, 40 year project to do it, whilst you relocate or do whatever you want with it. But eventually we want them out of Scotland, but we'll give you the time to do it. And if they can make life easy for the remnants of the British state to do that in exchange for, I don't know, something on currency, I don't know. But these are, you know, this is fantastically speculative, but it is a serious bargaining chip, because a new Scottish state could make life difficult in terms of what you do with your nuclear weapons that are now on a new independent state. So that has had some attention, but not a lot. And it's interesting that the UK is not moving away from its reliance on nuclear weapons at all. So this issue is not going to go away. The Trident renewal is starting to get underway. The UK is going to increase its possible stockpile, and it's not going to tell us if it is increasing it or not. So there's a new strategic ambiguity that they're bringing in, which doesn't, you know, it can make sense depending on what views you have of nuclear strategy and policy, but you know, that is the policy that they're going for. It's not going to make that much difference anyway. Nuclear Twitter went into a bit of a meltdown with that British decision on the warheads, when I'm thinking, nobody cares. I mean, the Americans and the Russians are going to still do their nuclear arms control debates no matter what the British and the French do. The Chinese are modernizing. I mean, yeah, sure, they'll say that, oh, the British are going to have more nuclear weapons around, that means disarmament is a sham. Well, they were just going to jump on that anyway. You know, like, it doesn't actually change the material investments that are happening with nuclear weapon states around the world. So nuclear Twitter went into a bit of a, you know, silly meltdown over that. It's really not that important, because it doesn't change the situation very much. So it's the nuclear element that's only really been part of the discussion. And even then, sort of a bit of a footnote compared to the culture wars elements that are now taking over, which is far more toxic, you could say, counterintuitively. I mean, I'm happy to go into the more cultural elements, but so far it's just been the nuclear element. And of course, Wales is just not part of that at all. And the nuclear question of the Wales came up in the mid-2010s, I can't remember now, it was a bit earlier, when Carwyn Jones, the then First Minister of Wales, said, oh, they'll be welcome in Wales. You can put them in Milford Haven. Right in the LNG terminals, where one third of the UK's LNG comes in, you know, liquid natural gas comes in. I mean, nukes don't mix well with anything, but I wouldn't make one of your main gas terminals a first rank nuclear target as well, by putting a sub pen there. but Carwyn Jones faced a lot of opposition to that within the Welsh Assembly, now the Senedd, and within his own party in Welsh Labour as well. So he retracted those comments in a session afterwards, but he did make those comments, and I think it was one of those lines where, you know, possibly not really thinking much would come of it, but it did hit a nerve. So I don't think there's, politically, it's not an attractive option for an England trying to keep the Welsh happy, because I don't think many Welsh people or parties would want the nukes showing up in Wales either, especially in the middle of a gas terminal, which is right next to a national park as well. It's not ideal, is it? So, and Mark Drakeford, the current First Minister, has a long anti-nuclear history as well, and he's representative of a big part of Welsh Labour as well, more so than British Labour in that regard.
I mean, that's putting it very, very mildly, saying it's not ideal to put, a nuclear base next to an LNG terminal. But it illustrates this point that you mentioned earlier on of the role of, for better or for worse, the culture wars. Now, we've got two elements going on here. On the one hand, we've got strategic changes, not the dismantling of the British military post-Cold War, but its transformation in the aftermath of the Cold War. So, changes to the structure and the funding of the military, as you say, this discussion that's going on about renewing the nuclear arsenal. OK, so we've got this on the one hand, these strategic discussions. But at the same time, how much of this is affected by political culture in the United Kingdom, between the different parties, between the different nations? I mean, if we think of some of the big issues that we've seen emerging since Brexit, we've seen Conservative governments overwhelmed by Brexit and by coronavirus. We've seen the Labour Party dominated by the foreign policy positions of Jeremy Corbyn, which were controversial, and now no one really seems to know what Starmers are. And we've also got renewed calls for, Scottish independence, Irish unification, to a much, much lesser extent, Welsh independence. So, to what extent are these strategic developments, to what extent are these affected by political culture within the UK? And how are these changes, how are these affecting the impact that security and defence have on British political culture and party policy? And I suppose a final follow-up to that, how have these changed the role of the military and of security and defence in British political life?
I don't know is the honest answer to a lot of those questions. I can offer some insights, but I struggle to have a sort of confident opinion on any of this. But I think where I start is by saying that the one trend really that's obvious to me is the MOD as a manifestation of the British state is nowhere near as present as it was 30, 40 years ago, especially in Wales, but in many other parts of the UK, and include like Northern England in that as well. The martial manifestations of the UK state is much more of a Southeast England thing now, and Southern England, rather than Northern England, Scotland, and Wales, and of course Northern Ireland. So that is really. So there's been that continual shrinkage since 1991, and that reduced physical presence in the UK, and not just in terms of the bases, but the amount of people that officially work for the British military, they have that less tangible connection to the British state and what it is, what it stands for, the culture the MOD creates for better and worse, from the Unionist perspective. Today there are no Welsh naval bases. There used to be a lot throughout the long history of the Royal Navy in Wales. Now, this is not to say they were the wrong or the right decisions to cut those bases, but the political reality is that the Royal Navy, which used to be extremely well representative of Welsh sailors and Marines, just has virtually no presence in Wales now. Historically, the Welsh have been very active in the Royal Navy, and J.D. Davis, a naval historian, in his book, Britannia's Dragon, said that in the 19th century, in the Victorian era, the Royal Navy was arguably the only properly British, air quotes, British institution in the British Empire, because it was actually far more tolerant of these non-Anglo-Saxon cultures within the UK. And the Welsh cultural elite were cooperating or had a very good relationship with the Royal Navy, especially given the work of the Royal Navy around the Caernarfon Battery in northwest Wales in Gwynedd. You had a lot of maritime-orientated writings in the Eisteddfods, the cultural bardic competitions that were revitalised in 19th century as well. So that history, and it is history now. That connection to the Royal Navy just isn't there, apart from what personnel end up in the Royal Navy rather than actual Royal Navy presence in Wales, and outside of a few maritime museums like in Swansea, for example. So I think you see a real decline, especially from the Welsh perspective, in terms of its direct involvement in what the MOD does as a manifestation of the British state. So when big things happen in security and foreign policy or military deployments, fewer and fewer people in various parts of UK society directly feel the effects of it. So there's virtually no Royal Navy presence in Wales now. In the army, you have the big two regiments that were the Welsh Fusiliers and the Welsh Guards. They are now the Royal Welsh. They've been turned into one. Do you know where they're based? Tidworth. They're not even based in Wales. So, and again, I'm sure Tidworth is good for the needs of what the Royal Welsh actually do, probably is, but politically, culturally, you know, it doesn't look great. If you know, if I was a massive flag waving unionist, I'd be like, why isn't the single remaining Welsh regiment actually in Wales, where most of the people they're from? No, they're in southern England. And I wouldn't want to be quoted on this, but I think similarly it's what's slated to happen to the Scottish regiment as well. It's going to be based in northern England rather than in Scotland south. So politically, these are difficult optics, as people say, for the UK state from military and defence perspective, because it's the bases that bring in a lot of the money for the local communities, because people who, and especially officers who are on pretty good salaries, spend their money in the local communities. And it's extracting young people from these very rural communities and post-industrial communities and then putting them somewhere else in England rather than closer to home. So there are some difficult questions there in terms of, you know, is the MOD basing doing the most that it can for the unionists? And then in terms of the RAF, there's RAF Valley and St Asaph, two big bases. So arguably it's the RAF that has the biggest sort of footprint in Wales now. Also, the Machynlleth Loop is one of the most favourite low altitude aerial manoeuvring flying runs for the RAF and the US Air Force. I always use that line when I talk to US Air Force audiences. I tell them I'm from not very far from the Machynlleth Loop, and they know exactly where that is straight away. So that's me using some soft power, I suppose. But there's that. But then that enrages as many people as it entertains, because you know you'll have the aviation enthusiasts or people going for a walk and then just seeing aircraft flying below them when they're up on a mountain. But then, of course, locals and other people as well just hate the racket that they create. Aberporth as well is a former RAF base near my neck of the woods in Cardigan Bay. And that is now like a private defence industry site that does some high-tech testing with drones and missiles across Cardigan Bay. But again, very, very small scale, nothing very big. There's RAF Brodie in Pembrokeshire as well that does cyber security, but information on that base is quite limited. So it's a very small presence for the MOD in Wales. In terms of the, I can't really find much information on the composition of the officer classes within the MOD. They'll talk about personnel on the whole, which includes the enlisted and the lower ranks, which are more diverse, but not the officer class. And just based on people I know in the MOD, it's not a particularly diverse bunch. It's usually people from the same part of England and usually from the same social classes as well, especially the higher up the ranks that you go. So, you know, I think there are real social political issues that unionists need to think about if they think that there's a role for the MOD in the unionist politics that are, you know, we are now a part of, or for any proper anti-separatist political campaign that people want to engage in.
I agree with that. And I think what I find remarkable is the extent to which people who want to promote the UK union automatically assume, one, that the military always has a good reputation. Doesn't always, in a lot of communities in the country. So there's always, for example, several colleagues actually who looked at these civil military relations things in other contexts got worried when the government was starting to use the UK military to roll out COVID strategies. Turned out the UK government did it really well, right? Mm-hmm. I mean, they didn't screw it up. They screwed something up in Birmingham, but in the end, they worked it out and they did really well. But what worried me a little bit was the automatic assumption that however they used the military, the reception locally would always be positive. And that luckily there were enough people in MOD itself that understood that much better than, say, in the government in the Tory party. So that worked out. But that worried me a little bit, because there's this sense that, you know, people don't automatically love the military and they don't automatically love soldiers. It's always conditional. And luckily, some in the MOD understand that. Sometimes I wonder about unionists more broadly in the government, whether they understand that. Mm-hmm. And I think also that it struck me how there is this automatic belief that the military will always strengthen the union's case. That's to me a little bit remarkable in that sense. And I think there has to be more thought about the military's role in life, but it's just taken for granted in so many ways.
Yeah, I would agree. And the Aberporth base, as I mentioned, they have seen a lot of protests by local civil society groups and from a lot of the chapels as well, you know, because they are more or less pacifists. Not totally, not all of them, but they are of a pacifist leaning at least. And, you know, they refer to drones as Ader Angai, which basically means death birds. But obviously it rolls off the tongue in Welsh. It's quite a catchy term, fair play to them, Ader Angai. You know, they protest the use of Aberporth for weapons development and training and testing. And you know, these things do promote protests from certain political communities and groups, you know, civil society in Wales. But I think perhaps more important than that is the monarchy as well, because the monarchy is so important to the identity and the symbolism of the British military forces. And that'll attract as well as repel people in equal measure. So that is, you know, in terms of the culture wars, union politics, the monarchy will be a really important part in how the military forces are received. In many ways, there is that imperial flavour to the way the monarchy is spoken about in Welsh culture, I found in my experiences with the MOD, which rankled me a bit. You know, I've had to hold my nose a few times. But, you know, those issues are definitely there. And I think being more sensitive to devolved politics is something that a lot of individuals in the defence community as a whole, not just the MOD. And don't get me wrong, there's a lot of intelligent people and, you know, well-meaning and good people, but they are very ignorant about local politics. You know, not just in the devolved governments and countries, but, you know, in the poor parts of the UK that they might have very little to do with on a personal basis. So discussions about Scottish separatism in certain classrooms, like they'd be completely unaware of how the SNP has been in power for a very long time in Scotland. Right. And that the Scottish people have consistently voted through the Scottish Parliament for pro-independence platforms. It's not just something that's been done overnight with some outside interference. You know, there's a massive upswell of opinion in favour of this. And, you know, we're seeing perhaps the start of something like that in Wales. I don't know, but the opinion polls in the last 2 years are really interesting, especially given the skyrocketing membership of Yes Cymru, which was 2,000 before the pandemic started. Now it's at 18,000. The membership of Plaid Cymru is 11,000. So these things are happening. And I wonder, you know, it's only now that they're really starting to get a grip to the Scotland question about Wales. I mean, yeah, probably behind on that as well.
But it's also a sign. I mean, what bases, military bases, do is they also provide you a challenge of communication to the rest of the society. The less bases you have, the less distributed they are across the country, yeah, the less your officers and your military elite and the people who eventually end up in the staff college know these local communities and understand what's going on. And so that's something we've seen in other societies. There's always a problem in the French military of having too many bases, maybe in the south of France, in certain areas and regions and not in others, and also not capturing how society works. But the government has tried, and you mentioned the drones. The government has tried now, in the recent integrated review, was sort of signaling that the union suddenly does matter also in strategic terms. It came to what is your central area of research. Like, they wanted to build a spaceport in Scotland and develop AI projects, I think in Wales and other parts of the country, and distribute the space industry and make this a symbol of national renewal and unity. And this is actually the core of your research, astropolitics and space politics, but also as just not, like, what I love about your searches is that instead of disconnecting space politics from earthly politics, you actually always try to link it to concrete geopolitical and local political dynamics and see how all this, there's a throughput between all these different levels. I mean, from your work, I mean, how far can space politics or these kinds of projects act as a as a process or a means of unifying the British state? What role, and why do you think the current government has latched on to space as a means of reinvigorating a sense of British national identity?
So space has been, commercial space activity has been quite a success story for the UK from 2000 or so. And the UK Space Agency was set up in 2010 on the back of the successes of certain companies that were spun out of universities in doing various kinds of satellite services and small satellite manufacturing, especially. So today, what we're seeing is a sort of continuation or expansion, really, of continued government interest in seeing, oh, so private space economy stuff, that is actually a thing. You know, the business of satellites and everything that goes into making satellites, running them, and then making businesses and services and data out of what satellites do. So that's very much what the UK government likes. And a lot of this work is high-skilled, high-technology, a lot of spin-off support jobs in the wider economy as well. So it satisfies a lot of the existing macroeconomic thinking across the UK state and across a lot of bigger industries as well. So it ticks a lot of those boxes, which is why the UK is very interested in this. Space launch is something that's been spoken about for a very long time in the UK, and that's to launch very small satellites, because traditional satellites are measured in tons, the size of, you know, lorries or, you know, big cars. Small satellites in the British context, in terms of what might be launched from Scotland, would be something in the range of 100 to 150 kilograms. The very successful small satellite industry in the UK, from companies like Surrey Satellites, they're about 400 kilograms, 450 kilograms. Now, this small satellite launch thing is a possibility, and it's been something that some parts of the UK industry have been calling out for a very long time, but over 10 years, and the UK government isn't really pumping in a lot of money into this. At most, it's only given £50 million for this. There's a lot of talk on this, and yeah, because it's going to be based in Scotland, there's a lot of, you know, there's the unionist intent behind it as well. But as time goes on, you know, you either get Lockheed Martin to show up after getting about £30 million in the UK government, which they have, to do what they've done with New Zealand, effectively, with the small satellite launches there, or nothing happens because you're not willing to spend more money on it. So we'll see what happens in the next couple of years. Again, it's been mentioned quite a bit in the integrated review. So we'll wait and see what happens. And the trouble is with launch is that it's not the most profitable part of the space sector. It really isn't. Launch is really, really expensive. Also tricky as well. It's the most risky part of any space mission. So the most profitable parts for the space sector in the UK is component manufacturing, satellite manufacturing design, but more importantly, the services and the downstream data applications that you get from satellites. So it's using the data from the satellites and selling that data to businesses and government, or the services and the IT packages data products that you build on top of it. That's where most of the money is, but it's not something that's as exciting as, ooh, big shiny rocket goes whoosh, you know, because that looks great on the newspaper. It looks like you're doing something, rather than like, oh, there's a new smartphone app that uses satellite data in a certain way. Ooh, that's a bit boring. So there's that element to it as well. So again, I mean, I'm a glass half empty sort of person. I'm actually quite pessimistic, but again, we'll have to wait and see. And we're still not sure where in Scotland the site's going to be, either in Sutherland on the northern tip of mainland Scotland. And some of my friends are going to kill me for getting this wrong, but I can't remember if it's Orkney or Shetland is the other one. Shetland, I think. I think it's Shetland, but I'll get things thrown at me on Twitter for getting that wrong, I'm sure. But we're still not sure where in Scotland that is going to be, which shows how early on in the phases a lot of it still is. After many, many, many years of talking about it, they've been talking about it for as long as I've been studying this, which is quite a bit now. So yeah, it may get there eventually. But as one of my friends at Northumbria University, Chris Newman, says, a professor of space law, we're not the only country talking about doing this and pumping money into it. The EU is doing this. They are pumping money into small satellite launches. You know, the United States is already doing it. The, you know, Lockheed Martin has a small satellite launcher in New Zealand already up and running, doing stuff now. China's getting into it as well. And, you know, China and America can just pump money into it. The EU can't do it on that scale, but they can do it more than Britain can. So in terms of these big unionist projects, yeah, they talk it, they speak about it, and this is true of the levelling up stuff as well. But where is that money, how much of it, and where is it actually going? Those are the real difficult questions. And what's really weird is that the attitude from London seems to be, we just need the UK state to spend money in these places, but and then put the union flag on top of it. Like, I'm from Wales, I saw the EU flag everywhere, all that Objective One money, all the ERDF money, you know, the union, the EU union flag was everywhere. And yet, you know, Wales on majority basis voted to leave. So it's like, yeah, there's a real disjointed thinking here. And then, of course, the levelling up fund seems to be the UK government wanting to spend money in areas that are devolved, like transport. So you got the issue, again, sorry, this is a very Welsh-centric talk, but, you know, the M4 relief road in Newport, where the Welsh government and Parliament decided, no, we're not going to build a relief road. This is not the way to resolve the transport issues in Gwent. Which, like, okay, fine. But the UK government and the Tories are in, you know, the Welsh Tories as well, are intent on reopening that up. And the UK government is basically saying, we want to build that road, but not really respecting that, yeah, you have no say on this, it's a devolved matter. But the UK Levelling Up Fund now is intent on making UK government projects on areas that are devolved. So again, even if they spend the money, the way they're doing it is going to upset more people and further poison the discourse as well, because they seem unable to be willing to work with the devolved governments, even on areas where they might actually agree on some projects. So for me, space is like, well, they're not really putting in that much money into it. So it's not as important as the other sort of unionist spending projects that might be going on.
I mean, speaking there of astral politics, sort of one of the few strategic survivors of Cold War thinking and the continued theme of astral politics in the current day. I mean, we're talking there about the relationship between sort of terrestrial and orbital strategies and technologies and government plans to build, say, a spaceport. I vaguely recall shortly after Brexit, a UKIP politician saying that he wanted to invest in asteroid mining. I just looked it up on my phone there, and constructing an interplanetary colony ship. Which raised the alarming prospect that humanity's first contact with the Martians would be through UKIP, which would have been interesting. But speaking there of the relationship between Earthbound and space technologies, we're looking at the role of technology and institutional responses to these technological shifts. Now, in the 30 years since the end of the Cold War, we've seen all sorts of changes in British political structure, British political culture, changes recently in leadership in the White House and in the role of NATO and the expanding European Union. And at the same time, we've been seeing increasingly this shift from sort of terrestrial Cold War strategic concerns to more sort of non-state and deterritorialized threats. So speaking as a recovering geographer, so putting on my old geographer hat, to what extent does Great Britain still have a shared strategic culture in these old areas of defence and foreign policy and these new ones, well, new, like 30 years old? To what extent do we still have a shared culture, or to what extent have we now got four different political cultures?
I think in terms of defence and the more martial aspects of British culture, I would say it's not particularly distinct at the moment, because the British state has really been the only formal actor to doing any of this, but also that, again, from the Welsh perspective, a lot of Welsh people saw themselves as full members of a British Empire. So if we're taking a longer historical point of view, loads of Welsh people saw the British Empire as their way to get rich, to get ahead in life. It was their way into certain political, social, cultural, economic opportunities, but also in terms of wider civil society, it was a way to combat overt Englishness, because it was a recognition of you know, a British empire was not something that was English as such. The Welsh in particular were, very sort of, already spoken about the Royal Navy and the way the Welsh saw the Royal Navy as part of their navy. But it's worth noting that the Royal Navy named a lot of their ships after Owain Glyndŵr. You can't imagine a lot of state navies putting the name of one of the most successful rebels of one of the first places that state conquered and annexed militarily on some of their warships. So there's been many versions of, various English bastardizations of Owain Glyndŵr as Owen Glyndŵr, in various generations. But also, the Royal Navy has had a lot of Welsh ship names to recognize that sort of Welsh part of the Navy as well. And then regimental cultures in the army as well. Well, the British Army is not an army. It's a collection of regiments, so we're really talking about regimental culture. And of course, the Welsh regiments tend to have more Welsh things, although the British Army did ban the use of Welsh in the 19th century as well. So there's sort of the linguistic cultural divides there. So I think in terms of longer term strategic culture, I would include the Scots in this as well. It was very much part of the pan-British culture because it was all sort of subsumed in that. And a PhD thesis by Maelor Powell at Swansea University, who looked at Welsh language media in the First World War, the main thrust of the narrative there early on in the war was that they were pro-intervention in the First World War because they saw it as helping a small country, Belgium, being invaded and occupied by its big ghastly neighbour to the east, against which it had no chance by itself. So again, the small country protection thing, and that was the line pushed in a lot of the Welsh language media in the approach to the First World War. And by sort of implication, they're seeing the British Empire as having a right to protect the interests of small European countries. So in that sense, they thought that the Welsh, or Wales or Welsh culture was served by the British Empire as well, not just it serving it. So, and I think a lot of Welsh people today are in denial about, the Welsh were part of the British Empire. It wasn't an English empire. Of course, medievalists can talk about an English empire in terms of English kings subduing and conquering various parts of the British Isles, but, including Wales. But in terms of, early modern period and, the global British Empire, the Welsh and the Scots, and the Irish as well were part of it. But, and of course, in the 19th century, the Welsh answer to cultural imperialism from the English, especially religious cultural imperialism, was to do their own act of settler colonialism in Patagonia against the Tuatha. So, the Welsh, colonized as well as colonizers, really. And in terms of the recent Black Lives Matter issues with slavery and the legacies of empire, Thomas Picton was one of the big figures in Welsh military history that came up in that, because Thomas Picton is a well-remembered air quote hero of the Battle of Waterloo, but he was also the governor of Trinidad, if I remember correctly. And he was accused of very, very harsh governor practices and governing practices and torture, and was also, as part of the slave trade and colonialism, because he was the governor of Trinidad, and a lot of his wealth was based on that imperial system. So and those discussions have come up in the last year, and that again further complicates the image of the MOD and British, the role of the British military in political culture today, and Wales is not immune from that. Wales was very much part of the British Empire. Now, of course, there are people who weren't, but I think there's a view, again, in Wales that it's a more pacifist political culture, which it isn't. It's as martial as anywhere else. It's just that there is a political pacifist tradition in Wales, but it's not the political culture. So, and in that way, Wales isn't unique. It's just like any other country. It's a diverse political entity. So for me, I think that separate culture would only emerge after independence, because foreign policy and defence have just been so British that, and other countries and other cultures have seen themselves as part of that one way or another, rather than separate from.
So just the kind of elephant in the room throughout this discussion has been the European Union, right? I mean, I'm like I'm more of an EU guy than in terms of research than I think Russell's, but we're both, that's both one of our main areas of focus. And we've touched on the Brexit issue throughout. But one of the things we've hoped to do in these podcasts is not focus too much on Brexit, because it subsumes everything else. It always threatens. And one of the, we're hoping to maybe be part of a post-Brexit conversation about where this country goes from here. But you know, you can't escape the EU. And I think what's interesting is that actually one of the first issues that popped up before the Irish border, which was the border on the island of Ireland, you know, before that popped up, was Galileo and actual astropolitics. And the more time was expended discussing that as the issues around the island of Ireland loomed up. That was also interesting that people preferred to argue about Galileo than that was very 2017. But it does show that there are a lot of areas of cooperation in astropolitics, in geopolitics, and in just basic regional security and defense policy. A lot of points of contact with the EU and UK, however much the UK wants to diverge. And as somebody who's, you know, you've had a lot of this work experience in the UK defense and strategy circles, you have also, you're also grounded in a different political culture to many because you come from this Welsh context. I mean, what would your advice be to the EU in terms of how does it sort of deal with these issues between these diverging parts of the UK? And how does it balance that with trying to build, because it's going to have to somehow deal with all these different parts of the UK and develop a policy for interfacing with them, and yet still needs the UK as a security and defense and astropolitics partner. So how do you think that you should balance these two different pressures and find some sort of stable relationship with the UK in the context of astropolitics, geopolitics, and regional security and defense policy?
I'm trying to decide which word gives you more more terror, really. Is it Brexit or Galileo these days? I think in general, especially from a space perspective, the UK is far better inside looking out than outside looking in. And that seems to be what's happened with the Horizons research program, which is great. That was sort of quietly agreed as part of the Brexit deal. And I go, thank God for that, because, you know, it's just things are happening on such a scale when the EU actually acts in a coherent fashion that the UK is just going to be swept along by whatever happens there and in the United States and to a lesser extent China as well. So in space, I think with the Defence Security Act, you've got NATO and the EU, which are important here. So, of course, the UK is still a big part of NATO, but when it comes to space power and astropolitics, the EU is the European show in town, and the European Space Agency. And of course, it's worth pointing out for your listeners that the European Space Agency is not a member or not a part of the European Union, but they are closely interlinked. The European Space Agency is the prime contractor for most of European Union space policy, and the EU is the single biggest contributor to the European Space Agency project. So the UK is still in ESA, but it is not in the EU. But that's a rabbit hole I'm more than happy to go down, but I don't think we have enough time. But the EU is building tangible infrastructure in space with clear military implications. Galileo is one of them. The UK has to respond to that and has to find its way around it. And I said this when this all blew up in the news in 2018, that there's no way the UK is going to get those defence contracts for building the sensitive, most lucrative parts of the Galileo navigation technology, because the rules for the project say EU member states only. But we can still get access to the service for our militaries subject to negotiation, because Norway and America are looking to do that as well. In the same way that European states already have access to the military grade services of GPS, you know, privileged access to the service. And that is a trajectory we're going down. Last year, the UK government said, we're not doing a like-for-like replacement for Galileo. It costs too much and there's too much of a faff. I'm like, hooray, I was right all along. So now they're looking at alternatives. But that shows how, you know, that infrastructure is there. It's built. We have to do something with it. And it's better for the EU and the UK that we are seeking, you know, we will eventually be using that in the same way we will GPS with the Americans.
Fantastic. Thank you. I suppose a final question, as we're running out of time, is there anything that you think we've missed? Anything that you think should be flagged up?
I don't know. I think in terms of especially the more European sort of focus of your studies and research and also the audience here, is that it looks to me that it's in space policy that that EU is one of the most coherent and consistent actors, or as an actor compared to other projects, or, you know, common security and defence policy. I don't know what's going on there apart from just creating more acronyms and initializations, really. But in space, you have actual things being built and deployed on a large scale. You know, the Galileo and Copernicus systems, for example. You have the future question now of the European Space Agency as an independent entity, even though it is highly interlinked in the EU space systems. And now in ESA, there's a massive member of it that's not a member of the EU, whereas before it was just Switzerland and Norway. But now you have the UK as a big non-EU member of ESA. So there's a lot of changes, I think, that will be coming over the next 15, 20 years as these institutions find a new balance. But as the EU realises 20 years of funding and talking about being an autonomous actor in space, and I can see the tangible material reality matching the words that are being said. And I can't say that for all of the EU's initiatives or for any state initiatives in many ways. So I think for the long term, the EU is going to continue to be a massive actor in space, far more relevant for military space in Europe than NATO would be, because NATO is pretty much the Americans in space. So for me, the EU is more important for future military space in Europe than NATO. So I would highly encourage your audiences to get stuck into that.
I think that might be the first episode of the podcast where we've ended on a positive note. I quite like that. So thank you to all of our listeners for joining us on this. And a special thanks to Dr. Bleden Bowen of the University of Leicester for this extremely insightful look into the EU, UK and astropolitics.
Thanks.
And we'll see you for the next one.
Diolch yn fawr. Thank you very much.